Well, good morning, Nexus. It seems my luck has finally run out. Last week, I'm filming in a t-shirt. It's so hot. This morning, I'm in a winter jacket here. It's a little bit cold, but I'm at one of my favorite places over in Galt. And this is a little place just off of Blair Road, looking over the Grand River. I love it here. It's a beautiful view. And sure, it's a little bit cold, but we'll make do this morning. You know, when Zoe first started attending school in JK, the teachers and Kristen and I, we noticed that she was having a little bit problems with focusing and reading and paying attention. And so we took her to the eye doctor, and it turns out after some tests, she had a paralyzed nerve in one of her eyes. And so the doctor prescribed this little video game for her. The idea was that to compensate for the paralyzed nerve, we had to strengthen the other muscles around her eye, the other nerves. And so what we had to do was have her play this game every single day for over a year. And this game, it was rather monotonous and boring. It was just like this 3D thing. She had to wear these special glasses and connect these dots together. And of course, for the first week, it was sort of new and novel, but over time, it just got so boring for her. She hated doing it. It was boring. It was mundane. And yet she had to keep at it to strengthen her eyes. She had to keep at it in order to learn to see and focus. And that's what I want to talk about this morning, learning to see and focus. You know, we've been talking over this series, this Goat on the Cow series, about how it's so hard sometimes to recognize moments when we bump into God. We often miss these moments, and a lot of times it's because, as Jesus says, we can't see, we don't have eyes to see. And so we've talked a lot about that, but the question sort of still remains, how exactly then do we improve our vision? How do we learn to see and recognize those moments when we've bumped into God? Well, what I want to do this morning is share with us four exercises that I think can help us strengthen our vision, strengthen our eyes. And like Zoe's exercises, they aren't exactly dramatic or necessarily inspiring. In fact, they can be a little bit mundane, but the key is this: I think if we stick at them over time, it will help us learn to see, strengthen our vision, give us eyes to notice when we've spotted a goat on a cow, moments when we've bumped into God. The first thing is this: it's a mindset shift. You know, I think many of us probably believe in God, but we don't always expect to bump into God. And I think there's a reason for this. You know, there's a priest out there, his name is Father Stephen Freeman, and he has this analogy that I think works really well. He talks about how many of us live in what we consider or think of as like a two-story universe, a two-story cosmos. And he says this causes problems because then we fail to see God. This is what he says about his little analogy. We live here on Earth, the first floor, where things are simply things and everything operates according to normal natural laws, while God lives in heaven, upstairs, and is largely removed from where we live. To affect anything here, God must interrupt the laws of nature and perform a miracle. That's the idea Freeman's getting at. If God's going to come and bump into us, it means God's going to have to sort of come down from upstairs and perform a miracle. And, you know, some of us believe that's possible, while other of us struggle with why God decides to come downstairs sometimes and not others. But practically speaking, no matter where you are on the spectrum there, what it means is that most of us tend to think that we're living alone on this first story and rarely bump into God. But what Freeman says is we need to recover a one-story vision of the universe, a bungalow vision of the universe, you could say. We live on the same floor as God. It's almost like we're more like roommates with God than anything else. And when you're roommates, of course, you should expect to bump into people from time to time. You know, Kristen and I, our first apartment was on Fairway Road in Kitchener, and we lived there for 2 years in this three-story apartment complex. And what's amazing to me is that we lived there for 2 years, and yet I can count on one hand the amount of times we bumped into or interacted with neighbors. I mean, I don't know if everyone was just non-social, maybe we were non-social, I don't know, but we hardly ever bumped into anything. In fact, the only time that we ever interacted with neighbors is when they were trying to sell us stuff. It was a bit of a weird place, to be honest, but we'd get knocks on the doors. The guy was trying to sell me his coffee table. One time he was trying to sell me a pink dress for Kristen. It was bizarre, but beyond people trying to sell me stuff, we'd never bumped into our neighbors. Now, our second apartment was actually in Galt, not far from here, actually, and We lived on the third floor, and there was just two apartments right across from each other, and we lived across from our friends. And the thing is this, in that apartment, we bumped into them all the time. Not only could we hear them coming and going and doing other things, we ran into them and saw them so frequently. In fact, they were a very hospitable couple. At least three times a week, they would invite us over for drinks, some sort of meal. It's like we are practically roommates. We saw them so often. And what Freeman is saying is that we need to recover this one-story vision of the universe, that we're not living down here and God's up here, but that we occupy the same floor. We're roommates. And when you're roommates, you can expect to bump into each other from time to time. We must reclaim this idea that God is active and present in our world. God is not some upstairs reclusive neighbor that we hardly ever see or hear from. In fact, I'm inclined to think we need to recover more of a Celtic understanding of spirituality. And one of the things that I'm really fond of is the idea in Celtic spirituality that heaven, God's realm, is always 3 feet away and invisible. But there are some places where God is much closer. God's realm is paper thin. It's just slightly apart from us. But even at its most, God is always just 3 feet away and invisible. And I mean, one of the practices I think we can start doing as a community if we want to improve our vision, improve our eyesight, is kind of repeat that mantra. Remind ourselves often when we're walking down the street, when we're doing family life, when we're at work. Remind ourselves, heaven, God's realm, it's only always 3 feet away and invisible. And when you start reciting that mantra, when you start internalizing that, it reminds you God is always close. And when God's close, there might be times when you run into God. Second, I think we can be people of hope. You know, as Willie Jennings says, hope is not some sentiment. It's actually a discipline. It's the discipline of seeing the world through enchanted eyes. It's the discipline of not giving in to despair, refusing to give in to despair. It's the discipline of reminding ourselves that help is available and coming in the future. I mean, remember Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning? The book came about because he was imprisoned at Auschwitz. And of course, he had a nagging question while there. How is it that some people are able to carry on in spite of being exposed to some of the worst atrocities committed to humans? How is it that some people are able to move forward and endure and others are not? I really like one reflection in his book because it speaks to the nature of hope. This is what he says. The prisoner who had lost his faith in the future, his future, was doomed. With his loss of belief in the future, he also lost his spiritual hold. He let himself decline and became subject to mental and physical decay. Usually this happened quite suddenly in the form of a crisis, the symptoms of which were familiar to the experienced camp inmate. Usually it began with the prisoner refusing one morning to get dressed and wash or to go out on the parade grounds. No entreaties, no blows, no threats had any effect. He just lay there, hardly moving. If this crisis was brought about by an illness, he refused to be taken to the sick bay or to do anything to help himself. He simply gave up. Hope might seem like a sentiment, but it's a matter of life and death. It's the discipline of refusing to give in to despair. But to discipline ourselves as people of hope, it requires us to look for something beyond ourselves, a power that's greater than us and outside of us, something that is beyond our present circumstances and what seems intuitively obvious, or the facts of the matter, the facts that are right in front of us. There's actually this great story in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 37, and in it, the prophet Ezekiel, he's being given this vision by God, and in it, he's being given a tour by God of this valley, and it's filled with these dead, dry bones. And of course, Ezekiel is writing to people who are in exile. He's writing to the Hebrew people who have been carted off to Babylon, and they've been there for some time now, and they've kind of given up hope. They've resigned themselves to their fate. What seems obvious to them is that they're They're never going to get home. They're never going to escape. They're never going to have their freedom again. And so they're discouraged. And so Ezekiel's relating this vision to them. He's touring this valley of dry bones. And then God interacts with him and says this, "Son of man, can these dry bones live?" And I said, "Sovereign Lord, you alone know." Then he said to me, "Prophesy to these bones and say to them, 'Dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord.' So I prophesied as I was commanded. And as I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound, and the bones came together, bone to bone. And I looked, and tendons and flesh appeared on them, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then he, God, said to me, 'Prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, son of man, and say to it, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Come, breath, from the four winds, and breathe into these slain, that they may live.' So I prophesied as he commanded me, and breath entered them. They came to life and stood up on their feet, a vast army." This is a vision that's been given to Ezekiel by God. This is his mystical encounter, you could say. It's his goat on cow moment. He's bumped into God, been given this vision, and this is how it concludes. "Then he said to me, 'Son of man, these bones are the people of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up and our hope is gone. We are cut off. Therefore, prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. My people, I am going to open your graves and bring you up from them. I will bring you back to the land of Israel.'" This vision is given to Ezekiel for the people of Israel who are stuck in exile, these people who are losing hope and resigning themselves to despair. And this message comes to them, this story comes to them and reminds them, there is something beyond you. There is hope outside of you and outside of your present circumstances, because God is not finished with your story. Hope doesn't spring from rational, logical conclusions about the facts. It transcends facts. It has us and prompts us to look beyond what is immediately obvious. It prompts us to move beyond and see beyond our present circumstances and reminds us there is help from outside of us. You know, I have to confess, I'm tempted by fatalism regularly. I can be a fairly pessimistic person from time to time, and right now, there's a whole lot of reasons to feel pessimistic about the world. There's COVID, there's climate change, there's the incredible division and divide, it seems, that's infecting everything from politics to religion. It feels like our world has never been so divided, and it's easy and tempting to give in to despair. It's easy to give up hope. But hope is a discipline, a worked-on discipline. Hope is the work of insisting that beyond reason, beyond the facts, there's something outside of us that will not allow our story to end in final defeat. And when we work on that discipline slowly, like Zoe's eye strengthening practices, when we work on that slowly, insist on being people of hope, our eyes start to adjust, even in the darkness. You know, Kristen and I have been married for 16 years now, and we still don't really have the greatest bedtime routine, because she always goes to bed much earlier than I, and this has caused no end of problems, because at night when I go to bed, I'm left with sort of two uncomfortable options. I can either, one, go into the room and it's dark upstairs and I can't see anything, so if I turn on the light, what ends up happening frequently is that Kristen gets very upset with me. "Why are you turning on the lights? Why are you waking me up?" And I'm like, I gotta see so I can disrobe and get into bed. The other option, of course, which I've tried, is to just fumble my way in the darkness. Inevitably, I end up bumping into something, knocking something over. And of course, that upsets Kristen as well. "You woke me up. Why can't you just get into bed without making noise?" And I'm like, "I'm sorry, but lately, I have a new tactic. What I do is I enter the bedroom in its darkness and I just stand there. And here's the thing, if Kristen ever woke up, I'd probably look pretty creepy just standing in the darkness there. But what I'm doing is, if I go into the room and it's dark and it's bedtime, what I'm doing is I'm giving myself time for my eyes to adjust to the darkness. And when you stand in the darkness long enough, eventually your eyes learn and begin to see. And when I do that, I can make my way without turning on the lights, and without bumping into things. It's the perfect solution, so I'm gonna stick with that. But this is the idea of hope. Hope is the discipline of learning to see in the present darkness, waiting in the darkness until light, there's enough light for us to see our way around. Third practice. You know, in the book of Acts, there's this story where Paul comes to this city called Lystra, and he's trying to preach to them and explain to them how God and Christ have been active in their lives, even if they didn't know it. But he's got a problem, you see. These people, they have no history. They've got no knowledge of the history of the Hebrew people. And so he's trying to explain God and Jesus to a people who have no idea about any of that history. And so it's a bit of a challenge for him. How does he explain how God has been active in their lives, even when they don't know anything about the scriptures? And you know, what he says to them, I think, is an interesting clue for us, for those of us who sometimes, I think, have trouble understanding or seeing when we've bumped into God. I think what Paul says here can be a guiding light, a clue for us in how we can train our eyes to see these moments as well. And so Paul says this to them, God has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your heart with joy or gladness. I love this. Paul is explaining to them, hey, listen, this God I want to tell you about, he's been in your lives this entire time. You just haven't been able to see it. Paul is acting almost like a tour guide, you could say, almost saying, listen, let me explain to you the way that God has been present and active in your life and how you just haven't been able to see it. Let me show you a few things. You know, I remember the first time Kristen and I went scuba diving together. It was in Cuba, and of course we did the test in the pool. You go down, can you breathe underwater, all that. And then you go and you do this little written test. You go out on a boat and they put weights around you to sort of drag you down and vest in the air tank. And we, overboard we go and we're down underwater. And of course we're with a guide, but immediately when we get down there, right, I'm having all these crazy thoughts. So we're by this coral reef and I can see that it's beautiful, but I'm struggling because they have these weights on you, but they also have a vest. And so to find your place, you can add a little air, which will bring you up, or you can take the air out, which will sink you. And I can't get the hang of it. So I'm either putting in too much air and going up too high, and the guide's like, come back down, or I'm taking too much out and I'm sitting on the bottom of the ocean floor. And I'm having trouble because I'm looking, of course, at my air tank. I'm paranoid. I don't want it to run out. I'm looking for sharks, of course. I'm scared I'm gonna get eaten. I'm so distracted. And finally, the guide comes right up in front of me and he's like, look at me, follow me, look at me, follow me. And it was an amazing thing because once he had my attention, he was able to take me and Kristen and show us the most remarkable things about this coral reef. While I was distracted and looking around, paranoid about sharks, eventually when he got my attention, he took us into this coral reef and he showed us there in that little cove, in that little cubbyhole, there was an eel. And then later on, we saw a blowfish and a barracuda, which of course freaked me out, so did the eel. But he's showing us all these beautiful things just hidden, just outside of view of the coral reef. You had to be looking for these creatures in order to see them. And without that tour guide, I would have been left there, probably excited, but just struggling with my equipment, too distracted to see the beauty and the intricate details of the coral reef and the life under the sea. And this is what Paul is doing here. He's acting as the tour guide. Let me show something to you that maybe you haven't seen before. God has been with you and present with you this whole time and you haven't noticed it. God has been present in the rain and in your harvest. God has been present with you around the table with food and with gladness and joy. In those moments, you have encountered the God I'm speaking of, says Paul. And I think this is a telling and valuable clue for us. If you're wondering when you have bumped into God, Paul, the tour guide, says, follow the joy, follow the gladness, start there. On tables, with food, with friends, and laughter. If you want to know where you've bumped into God, follow the joy. Follow the joy because in those moments you bumped into God and you may not have noticed it. I mean, have you ever had one of those moments, right, where you're sitting around a table with good friends and maybe some great food and wine and you're having great conversation and you look at your watch and it's like 8 o'clock and then you're laughing, you're having a great time with food and your heart is glad, you're filled with joy, you're having a great time, and the next time you look at your watch, it's like 2 a.m. and you're like, my goodness, where did the time go? I mean, in those moments, it's like time is relative, like you've entered another dimension. It's almost like reverse Narnia. Instead of time slowing down in the outside world, time flies by. You've entered this sort of mystical world where just time becomes something that just passes by so quickly. And in those moments where our hearts are filled with gladness and joy, it is in those moments, Paul says, you've bumped into God. God has been there. Maybe we just didn't notice it. For Paul, it's like, it's there. Do you see it? In those moments of joy and gladness, you bumped into God. And for those of us who are training our eyes to see, trying to strengthen our vision so that we notice these moments, this is a great place to start. Follow the joy, follow the gladness, because there in those moments are divine encounters. And you know, the interesting thing for me about Paul is that for him, this became, joy became like a constant companion for him. In fact, in one of his letters, he's writing to the Philippian church. He's actually writing from prison. And so this letter has become known as his joy letter because he talks about joy and rejoicing all the time. But the interesting thing to me is this. Paul is writing from prison here. He's not writing about joy and gladness, you know, sitting on an all-inclusive resort beach, sipping mojitos. He's not writing from his little nook and cranny reading spot in his library while sipping tea. He's not writing this while out on some nature exploration. No, he's writing this from prison, the absolute worst place, the place that you would expect there to be no joy. And Paul's writing from there, and he says this, I have learned how to be content with whatever I have. I know how to live on almost nothing or with everything. I've learned the secret of living in every situation, whether it is with a full stomach or empty, with plenty or little, for I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me. Paul's in this, what seems like the worst of situations, and he's filled with joy. And it's like, what's his secret? And I mean, for this reason alone, we should study Paul. I mean, anyone who's figured out the secret of being content in any and every situation, well, they're worth our time and attention. I mean, what was his secret? I mean, here's the thing. He points to this. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And, you know, Paul is not being some self-help guru here. He's not writing another manifesto, you could say, that you could find on any bookshelf in a bookstore under the self-help section. No, for him, the secret is it's all about looking beyond himself, looking outside of himself. In looking to Christ, he finds the strength to endure, and it brings him joy. He's bumping into God all the time, but that can sound a little vague to us, right? It can be like, okay, well, how do I look to Christ and find strength there? It's like, there must be more to the secret. What is this secret of being content and finding joy in all circumstances? And you know, there's a letter later on, I believe it's Thessalonians, where Paul, I think, gives up a little bit more of his secret around finding contentment everywhere. He says this in Thessalonians, always be joyful, never stop praying, give thanks in all circumstances. Always be joyful, never stop praying, and give thanks in all situations. Ooh, I like this. It's like a secret ingredient here, a recipe, you could say. And I think Paul is getting at is this, when he says, always be joyful, it's what we've been talking about, essentially follow the joy. Never stop praying, which is what? It's prayer is making ourselves available for God's presence. It's being on the lookout for God's presence, bringing ourselves closer to God, making ourselves aware, and then always give thanks. I'm intrigued by this. There's something about that. And this is the final sort of practice I want to talk about. There's the mindset shift. There's, of course, hope. There's joy. And then there's, I think, gratitude. And this is an interesting and telling one for me. I think gratitude is one of the best ways to strengthen our vision. It's one of the best practices we can do in order to help ourselves see more clearly, see those moments when God is present in our life, when we've bumped into God. And you know, the thing is, this should be almost obvious to us because we know that the happiest people in the world are people who practice gratitude. I mean, it's no accident in Scripture that grace and gift are the same word. That's the idea. When we receive something as a gift, it's a grace to us. And this is the beauty of gratitude. Something magical happens when we receive life as a gift. It becomes a measure of grace in our life. And for those of us who are trying to strengthen our eyes and see those moments when we've bumped into God, gratitude can be one of the most practical, helpful ways we can understand where and when we're bumping into God. I mean, consider this little exercise that Richard Beck suggests, and I love this. So I'm just going to read his suggestion for a practice, something maybe you can adopt as well. This is a little experiment he suggests. He says this: if you doubt the transformative power of gratitude, try this experiment. Pick anything in your life that is a source of dissatisfaction. Maybe it's your old smartphone with its bad battery, your junky car, or a less than satisfying job. Now make it a practice over the next few days to express heartfelt thanks for your phone, car, job, or anything else in your life. Be thankful that you have a phone or a car or a job. Millions of people don't have any of these things. So take time this week, as the old hymn exhorts, to count your blessings. Then sit back and watch the psychological magic do its work. Notice, when you count your blessings, how a source of dissatisfaction is transformed into a location of joy. Now imagine extending this thankfulness across every sphere of your life. Imagine what it would be like to experience everything in life, every moment, every possession, every task, every relationship as gift and grace. It would be absolutely transformative. No wonder gratitude makes people happy. I love this, and this seems to be Paul's recommendation as well. Practice gratitude, and chances are you're going to start bumping into God far more often than you think. And so I tried Richard Beck's experiment this week. One of the sources of dissatisfaction in my life right now is our car. I've wanted a new car for forever, but currently Kristen and I are driving a 2010 Toyota Corolla. And this month is its 11th anniversary with us. We've had this car for 11 years. It's passed 300K on it. Its clutch is going. It sounds like death when you start it up. All of my hubcaps are missing. Somebody stole a section of my side mirror off of it. There's scratches and dents all over it. There's Cheerios crushed in the back. This thing is just, it was in my mind, just this piece of junk. And the only reason we haven't got another car is because Kristen's a little frugal, we could say, and enjoys the fact that we don't have car payments. But I am almost embarrassed to drive this thing. It drives me nuts, this car, and I'm scared it's just gonna cost me a whole lot of money in the future. But I took up Richard Beck on his little experiment this week. I practiced giving thanks for the car every single day. And sure enough, the magic happened. When I was giving thanks for the car this week, I was reminded of the moment that we bought it, and we had just gotten rid of our Toyota Echo, this little hatchback car, and we were looking for a new car, and I wanted the Yaris. I liked the Echo size, and I remember we're looking at cars, and Kristen said to me with a twinkle in her eye, you know, maybe we should get a bigger car in case we need room for kids one day. And there, giving thanks for my car this week, I was reminded this is the car that I brought all three of my kids home in for the very first time. I was reminded that for almost 9 years now, this car has kept us safe. It's kept the valuable cargo of my family safe for all these years. As I was giving thanks for the car, I was reminded of all the road trips we've had as a family, times up to the cottage, times up to Tobermory, where a car has been packed, like not an inch of room left in there, but we made it. I was reminded of all the times I've sang my heart out in the car, the times that I've listened to podcasts. I remember a trip all the way up to Ottawa, and I listened to Serial, the whole first season of Serial on that road trip, and all these memories came back to me, all these times and special moments in that car, and practicing giving thanks refocused me. It gave me new eyes to see it, and while it's not a flashy, great car, it's done its job. It continues to do its job. It's become a gift to me. a place of grace. And I'm not sure how long this will last, of course, but in that moment this week, in those moments where I was giving thanks for it, I was reminded gratitude does change how we see things. It reminds us of how life is a gift. It gives us eyes to see and encounter God in ways we might not have imagined. And here's the thing about gratitude. Nothing factually changes with gratitude. My car is still an old, beat up, not flashy looking car. But when we look with the eyes of gratitude, these things, they don't factually change, but they become an experience of grace, an experience of gift. And I believe that's what this mindset shift does to the one story universe. I believe that's what hope, joy, I believe that's what gratitude, what all of them do. Nothing changes about the facts, but they push us to see something beyond the present, beyond the facts. They push us to see the world in a different way. And when that happens, we can receive life as a gift. And this is the interesting thing to me. When we receive life as a gift, it implies that there is a giver. Without a giver, I'm not sure how to see life as a gift. And here's my hunch. If this world is just physics and raw material and natural laws, then I'm not sure there's a way to experience life as gift. Sure, we might feel lucky to be alive, but that's very different than feeling grateful and that life is a gift. I mean, consider the difference between feeling lucky and feeling grateful. Feeling lucky might make us feel great, but there's also some negative side effects to that. If we're feeling lucky, if it means nothing, then we might end up coming to the same conclusions that Jean-Paul Sartre did. And for him, he described the world, of course, as this cold, empty void. And his conclusion about life is that while we might be lucky to be here and alive, he said this: every existing thing is born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. Now, that might seem like a really negative assessment about life, but those are, in a purely materialistic world, those are the facts. But we know through the whispers and longings of our hearts that this isn't true. We know deep down that we're not cosmic accidents. We know that we are here for a reason. And if we're here for a reason, if life is a gift, then we can experience all of this as grace. We can experience this as something from outside of us that's been bestowed upon us. All of life is a gift. And when life is received as a gift, our eyes are strengthened, our vision increases, and we are able to see more moments where we've bumped into God. And so to have the eyes we need in order to recognize the moments when we've bumped into God, these are the exercises we can do to strengthen our eyes. We can insist that we live in a one-story universe, that God is not up there and distant or reclusive, but that God is like a roommate who we're going to bump into from time to time. God is never distant, but always 3 feet away and invisible. We can be people of hope who resist giving into despair. We can be people who follow joy, and we can be people who always give thanks. And these practices, they might not be extraordinary or dramatic. In fact, a lot of times they'll feel mundane and boring, but when we practice them over and over again, what we might find is that we start bumping into God a whole lot more often than we realize.